and welcome to episode 4 of Rings and Rituals, The Great Wave, from the Payne and McKay series Rings of Power. I'm Marilyn, the librarian of Rivendell.
And I'm Sara, Shield Maiden of Rohan, and we're delighted that you've joined us. Today we'll be reviewing what we mean by ritual, and then applying those concepts to different examples of ritual that we find in this fourth episode of the TV series. We'll explore them using a set of questions to reveal how Payne and McKay depicted the cultures that they're adapting to their series.
Be sure to get in touch with us. A discussion of two is an adventure, but we'd love to have more voices join us. You can email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com. And or you can join our Rings and Rituals channel on Lorehounds Discord. We'll include all that information in the show notes.
And we also want to say that we are a proud affiliate of the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcasting Network, where you'll find all sorts of interesting podcasts on TV, films, books, video games, and other stories. Our thanks to all the listeners who support the Lorehounds through good ratings on Apple iTunes, during the Lorehounds Patreon, and other forms of donation. If you like what we're doing here, consider giving them a boost as well.
As our regular listeners know, we like to start with a review of our definition of ritual, particularly for anyone who might be joining us for the first time. Sara, what do we mean by ritual?
Well, a ritual is a repeated action, and it's something that's usually intended to either recognize or bring about some kind of change. It often has symbolic content, but it doesn't always. For example, brushing your teeth every morning and night is a ritual. And has no other symbolic content than keeping your teeth clean. But it can also be a form of making meaning, which doesn't have to be religious or spiritual. For example, fireworks on certain celebratory days. It can also create or reinforce communal identity, though there are also solitary and or personal rituals. Mm-hmm. Often ritual gives structure and meaning to the unimaginable, and it can also include humor, which can help one to bear the unbearable.
So we're going to keep these points in mind as we describe each ritual and weave in the following questions. What is the design of the ritual? What is the intent of the ritual? What is the outcome? And particularly, what does it tell us about the culture and the individuals in the culture?
So we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll bring you the meat, or the tofu for our vegan and vegetarian listeners, without the quail sauce.
Welcome back. We're going to review the ritual elements that we saw in this fourth episode, but to aid our listeners' memories, we'll begin each section with a synopsis of events. Please note, we are doing full-on spoilers throughout these episodes. If that isn't what you want, go and binge the entire season, and then come back and join us.
Okay, Miriam, do you want to give us our first synopsis?
Indeed I shall. In a dream, Muriel leads the blessing of the children, where mothers bring their infants in to receive their names and be blessed by their monarch. Instead, they are all overwhelmed by a massive wave sweeping over the land and smashing directly into the court. Muriel awakens as one of her servants opens the curtains and proclaims that it is a perfect day.
Well, so what rituals do we get here?
Well, we have the blessing of the children, in which only the mothers and the babies are present, as well as the monarch, in this case, of course, Muriel. But I have some questions because this turns out to be a dream. And so I'm wondering, is this actually a genuine ritual of Numenor?
I always took it as being a genuine ritual simply because it seems like something that she's totally comfortable with. So this is probably something that does happen on a regular basis. And then, of course, we get pulled out of the moment when she turns to the great big open window and she sees the wave coming in. So I've always read it as being a totally natural and ordinary thing to be going on, something that doesn't disturb her in the least until we get the wave. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, for a long time, I just assumed that it was a regular procedure for them. As you say, it all looks quite comfortable. And it's interesting to my mind that it's just the mothers and the babies.
Yes.
You know, that there are no fathers present or second mothers or, you know, single parents, right?
Right.
Beautifully dressed, very formal occasion. And lovely to see Muriel take the first child tenderly and ask the mother what name is been given to this child. So it's sort of a combination. It's almost like a baptism, really, mm-hmm. in a way, a welcoming into the community, as well as recognizing and acknowledging the individual identity of this new being. And then there's the rumble of the earthquake, and Muriel kind of riffs and says, well, sometimes our island kingdom needs to stretch a little to grow, just like you will stretch it, right? So smoothing it over, making sure that nobody's worried about it. And then, of course, you start hearing screams and water noises and whatever, and you think, okay. And it was an interesting moment because those of us who know the full story of Numenor thought, wait a minute, it's too soon. This isn't supposed to happen now. Yeah. So I'm not entirely sure that I can answer one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I think it probably is a regular event. Who knows how often or how frequently they have new babies to be blessed in Numenor, but it definitely doesn't end in the usual fashion.
No, so. It does seem to me to be, because you mentioned how it's only women and babies, it does seem to be a very female space.
Yes.
That they have created this ritual in, that perhaps there is a deliberate exclusion of anybody outside of this female space, that this is a coming together of women who have given birth, and mm-hmm. it is their moment mm-hmm. in which to present the baby to the queen. Mm-hmm. Of course, what I think we should also notice is that these are clearly women of a certain status.
I think so.
It doesn't look like your ordinary woman out on the street is able to partake of this ritual, because they really do look like women of a high status.
Yeah, and maybe that nobody kneels a Numenor, but that doesn't mean that you get to have your baby blessed by the monarch.
Yes. Or maybe they have separate things going on for those women. Who knows? But yes, this does look like something for the particular people.
But who else in Numenor would be qualified to offer a blessing? There are no priests.
No.
There are no clergy.
No, but that doesn't mean to say there aren't matriarchal figures.
Okay, I can buy into that.
I'm just riffing off the top of my head here. But.
Well, of course, we're supposing based upon the information that we've seen and been given.
Yeah.
I could picture heads of guilds, women heads of guilds, perhaps, or the wives of guildmasters. There's a lot of possibilities there. And of course, when the monarch is a man, it would have to be presumably his wife, mm-hmm. not necessarily a ruling queen, but still the queen.
Right.
Ones of high degree.
The vast majority of the monarchs have been male. There are some females.
That's right.
From Ankalime onwards, but relatively few.
Mm-hmm. Anything else we want to say about this before we move on?
No, I just think it's well worth noting. I'm glad you picked this one out. It's well worth noting that this definitely seems, to me anyway, to be a moment that is a regular celebration of the birth of children.
Yeah. I really thought it was beautiful. I loved it when it, you know, from the very beginning. And then, of course, the wave breaks and I'm like, okay. Which is a good way of demonstrating the kind of anticipatory shock that she's been living with for some time now. We don't know how long, of course, but
and of course I have so many other questions, how is it that Muriel is getting these visions, and also apart from that, in terms of storytelling, giving the game away, I mean, yes, okay, there are plenty of us who know that there will be a wave,
yes,
but it's an interesting choice, I think, to have it presented so early in the five seasons that we're supposed to be getting. Mm-hmm. It's not about the journey to the wave. It's about I'm trying to think about this the other way around. It's not about the fact the wave happens. It's about what happens on the way to getting the wave.
Exactly.
We know the wave is going to happen. Yeah, I got my ideas straight there, by the way. It just took me a second.
Bravo.
Yes, we know that wave is going to happen. Now, even those who didn't know about Numenor know that the wave is going to happen. It's just what happens in between now and then. Which is focuses very on the story.
Yeah. I could also see a case in which, people are open to say, well, I guess it was just her bad dream. You know, it's a classic bad dream. A lot of people had it, including Tolkien himself, of anxiety or it doesn't have to be a predicting dream. It can just be a dream.
Right.
Yeah. So that leaves, the folks who haven't seen the series before. And apologies if we've just given it away to anybody.
We did warn about spoilers at the start.
Spoilers of all sorts.
Indeed.
Okay, so let's carry on with the synopsis. One of Farazan's men rouses anger in a crowd about the elf in Numenor. Farazan's son, Kemen, warns him that there's a problem, and his father scorns him, saying, "Cleverness is for men of small ambition. I'd much rather that you were wise." Farazan promises the people that the sons and daughters of the Edain are more than capable of dealing with a single elf, and calls for drinks all round. Eärien is impressed, and Kemen seems depressed. He offers Eärien some of the free wine in hopes of helping her forget her troubles. But she replies, "My troubles have been too hard won to be forgotten." In court, Galadriel asks Miriel to form an alliance with her to fight Sauron and restore Halbrand to the Southland throne. Miriel rejects her, saying that Numenor has chosen another path. Galadriel requests an audience with the king, but she oversteps and winds up in prison next to Halbrand. Moving to the sea, the trials for the cadets are almost finished, but Isildur, once again, distracted by the sight of the western shores of Numenor and the women's whispering, deliberately lets go of a rope, and the subsequent chaos results in both he and his two best friends being cast out of the cadets. Isildur is devastated to have involved his friends, and Otamo and Valandil are furious.
Okay. So the only real sort of ritualesque thing we get here is that music that's played over this, the triplet rhythms that feel like those sort of sea chanty sea dances. I suppose what this does is it plays alongside that whole "the sea is always right" idea. There seems to be something very ritualistic about their presence on the sea itself. And actually that really plays because, of course, if we think about sailing culture back at a certain time in history, like I'm talking about the big sailing ships, there would have been a great deal of ritual on board some of these ships.
Oh, yes.
All part of the way in which life was. So, I don't know, do you think that it sort of plays alongside these ideas of sailing in history?
Yeah, I think, Bear is famous for his ability to take one melody and make it play for six different scenarios. And I think this is an example of it, because here we have the theme of Numenor, and it sounds nothing like what we heard when they were sailing into port. No, it's on the waves. It's active. It's very focused on what the actual work is. And I'm sure that there were many other rituals that they had, personal, private rituals. We already talked about the vow of return as being a majorly important ritual. But I thought it was lovely to have that because it shifts the tone very well. And an awful lot of training is also ritual, isn't it?
Yes, it has to be.
Repetitive, communal, intended for a particular purpose.
Passed down from prior experience and knowledge.
You wear special uniforms to designate your role. So all of those things, I think, would apply there.
Yeah. Okay. I think we're done with that particular bit of the episode?
Yep. Would you like to do the next synopsis?
I would be delighted. Okay. So we're back down in the Southlands. Arondir awakes in chains facing a group of orcs. A dying orc lies on the ground and Adar approaches him as the orcs once again form a double line for him, grunting respectfully. That's one of my favourite bits.
Me too.
Adar clearly has elven ears and features. He kneels down by the dying orc, touching his brow tenderly, and delivers a merciful death. The The orcs chant softly and depart with the body. Now, this is a wonderful moment, actually. Yeah. And I'll be honest, this is probably the moment when I thought, you know what, they're going to do something interesting with this series.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that is the relationship between Adar and the orcs in the way that they're being portrayed at this point.
Yes.
And I find what they've done to be really interesting, very thoughtful, very different to what we've seen in previous portrayals, very, very different to the orcs as presented by, for example, the Jackson films.
Yes.
Yes. Not only do they look different, but their behavior is slightly different. Yes, of course, you know, we'll see them later on fighting and all that. But we don't see this sort of thing happening at all. And talking about orc culture,
yes,
is very different.
Yes.
It's very unusual, right?
Yes, this is why I'm so pleased to be picking these pieces out. And it demonstrates that ritual is tied to culture very tightly. And the notion of orc culture, I mean, we probably, if we'd been asked to describe it, it would not involve soft chanting and bowing respectfully.
No.
Right? I mean, it's just that antithetical to what we usually think of as orcs. And it ties in nicely with the dilemma that Tolkien faced pretty much his whole life about the morality, the theological accuracy of creating a people which seemingly exist only to be killed.
Yes.
And yep. have no redeeming features, which he has countered in many of his writings that, you know, nothing was evil to begin with, not even Morgoth, the great foe, and of course, not even Sauron. So it does kind of make you stop and think, don't it? Or at least it did me.
It really does. We can even put side by side this merciful death that's been dealt to this dying orc by Adar with, if we go to The Lord of the Rings, the book, and we look at that moment between Shagrat and Gorbag when they're going through the pass of Cirith Ungol, and they're talking about old Uftak, who was hung up to dry by, they wouldn't rescue him. Why would they?
Yeah, yeah. They just left him there.
Exactly. I mean, a merciful death at the very least would have been to slip old Uftak some, you know, a knife or something, or you know, do something, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Here, what is interesting, of course, is that it's not another orc that's delivering the death blow. Mm-hmm. It's somebody else called Adar, which has to resonate with the Elvish for father, of course.
Yes.
And that in itself is interesting. And it, you know, it's got to bring us back to the origins of the orcs according to what we get in the Silmarillion, which of course is twisted elves. Mm-hmm. And Adar certainly looks like a twisted elf. But as you say, Marilyn, Tolkien struggled for the remainder of his life with how do I explain the orcs? And we know that he changed his mind half a dozen times, if not more.
If not more.
Because he never did come to a satisfactory conclusion about it, because it didn't chime with his own beliefs. The idea of, first of all, the possibility of either Morgoth or Sauron being able to create, because they can only twist. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the idea of being able to bring into being these creatures who are literally evil from conception, who have no opportunity for redemption. Who can never be good, and as you say, exist only to be target practice.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's not something I could see him being comfortable with.
It is interesting because I think it is sort of the starting point for an awful lot of, you know, sword and sorcery fantasy, Dungeons and Dragons, and so forth, of the vast armies of killable creatures.
Yes.
And yet they have language. They have, even in The Lord of the Rings, which is several thousand years after this, they have language. They have groups. They had two that you instanced in the Shelob's Lair saying, yeah, well, let's you and I slip off together and have some good times. You know, it's very difficult for a human author to write anything other than human creatures.
mm-hmm.
or human-like creatures. And as soon as you've done that with Tolkien's Catholic views, you have created creatures who have to have some sort of redeemable essence somewhere.
Yes.
According to his beliefs. And so here you have an orc tenderly stroking the brow of a fallen warrior and giving him a swift death. And the other orcs are chanting, Nampak Uglushar. He died honorably.
Honor? I mean, honor?
Honor.
Right.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Think about that. Certainly not any sort of thing that anybody else would recognize. And even now, you know, the elves, humans, dwarves, none of them could possibly think of an orc, I don't think, as having honor.
No, because the assumption is immediately that they don't, that they can't possibly, because it's not in them.
Yeah. And you can see that Avrandir, who was witnessing all this, is totally gobsmacked.
Mm.
I mean, bad enough that he's waken up from being whacked on the head.
Unpleasant enough.
His whole world is turned upside down because he notices. Well, I'm jumping ahead of myself here. I'll just say right now, he notices things about Adar that completely astonish him and confuse him. But what I'm getting from this is a culture that cares deeply for themselves and each other, though not for anybody else outside their culture, and who have this father figure, who they literally call father, to look up to honor, to respect, to turn to. It's really remarkable. It's really remarkable. Oh, and I should say that I got that translation from the Tolkien forum.
Right.
He died honorably. Mm. And of course, Nampak, we'll see in the future, which is death, basically.
Okay. Well, I will continue with the synopsis because this is actually a very interesting scene. Like I said, this is the one that made me go, maybe. Anyway, Arondir is astounded to be addressed in Quenya. Adar remembers Beleriand and says, "You've been told so many lies that even the rocks and the roots now believe them. To untangle them from all that would require the creation of a new world. But that is only something that the gods can do, and I am no god, at least not yet." He sends Arondir with a message back to Bronwyn's people. Now, I got a little twitchy when he started talking about gods, because gods, really? Anyway, I'm going to leave that there. Perhaps that's a discussion for another time, but that did make me twitch a little bit.
I don't know. I think if you posit, I mean, he remembers Beleriand, he speaks Quenya, he has elven-shaped ears. I could definitely see a scenario in which he was one of the very early elves who knew about the Valar.
Who aren't gods.
I know they're not.
Yeah.
See God as a sort of a stand-in for a word.
Fair enough. And it's probably a shorthand for Payne and McKay. How else do you explain the Valar?
And who knows if they've been given permission to use the word Valar?
Well, yes. Also, you know, a very good point.
That there may be some limitation there.
Well, the Valar are mentioned in the appendices of the Lord of the Rings, aren't they?
Well, that's true. That's true.
So they would have. But anyway.
Possibly.
Anyway. I will carry on.
I think it's a shorthand.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Okay, I'll carry on with the synopsis then.
Mm-hmm.
In Oz Tirith, it's become clear that there's not enough food. Theo goes back to the village with his friend Rowan to find more food, but Rowan deserts him when clouds cover the sun, and Theo has to fend off an orc with his sword hilt and hide in a well overnight. So, meanwhile, Celebrimbor thinks that Durin is hiding something, so Elrond goes back to Khazad-dûm. He tries to get information from Disa about Durin's whereabouts, and she claims he's far away. On his way out, he spots Disa and Durin talking together and with his elven sight can read their lips and see that, in fact, Durin is mining close by in an old shaft. He goes there and confronts Durin, who demands of him an oath of secrecy, hand to the mountain, to which Elrond swears on the memory of his father, "Anything you tell me here will end in my ears alone." Durin tells him Disa discovered Mithril, but King Durin has been restricting all their efforts to probe further because it is perilous to mine. There's a sudden rock fall, and Durin races into the cloud of dust to rescue the four dwarves who are in there. Well, we definitely have some ritual here, Marilyn.
Absolutely. And talk about immediate confirmation. You know, he says it's perilous to mine, and then...
Yeah, we didn't have to wait long for that one.
No, we didn't. Yes, Prince Durin calls for Elrond to swear the oath of hand to the mountain, to keep silence on all that is spoken now, and if this oath is broken, it will doom you and your kin to sorrow.
Ooh, dun dun dun.
Now, my first thought is, yeah, well, they're already there, right? Mm. You know, tell me that there's not been a life of sorrow up to this point on Middle Earth. But, also very joyful. But it is interesting, you know, the showrunners choosing particular words and what led them to include that little tag to the oath. I mean, you know, you might make a case that for some people, you swear an oath and you swear an oath, and there doesn't need to be any, if you don't do this, then this, because they believe that, you know, once you've sworn an oath, that's it. You know, your honor, your sense of yourself, your sense of connection with the other person, all of that would demand that you not break the oath that you just swore.
True.
But, for the dwarves, you know, truth and consequences, I guess.
I guess right? So. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, the thing is that we do know that Elrond will, in the rest of his life, go through huge amounts of sorrow.
Of course.
First, Celebrian, and then, of course, losing Arwen forever. So there is that. And, of course, there are... Well, there's the fate of Celebrimbor. No spoilers, but it ain't great, folks.
No, it's not pretty. It's definitely not pretty.
No, and, you know, Gil-galad also, yes, gets the pointy end of the stick. See what I did there?
Oh, I definitely see what you did there.
Yeah.
I'm sure it kind of burned him.
But, yeah, I mean, we do know that this is going to end up at the battle against Sauron in the Last Alliance, and there will be great sorrow and great death and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, to what extent was that going to happen anyway? Because Sauron's already here, spoiler alert.
Right.
And to what extent is it because of a broken oath?
That's the thing with these kinds of prophecies and statements of if this, then that. The reality is life is full of sorrow.
Yes.
One's life is filled with many different sorrowful events, as well as the joyful ones. So this sort of specific doom you and your kin to sorrow, I mean, it sounds kind of more like Morgoth and his curse on Húrin and his family. Now, that's being doomed to sorrow, I'm going to tell you.
Oh, that's pretty thorough.
And exceeds what sorrow I think one might expect to have in a lifetime, at least in my view.
Yes.
I also find it interesting, you know, for Durin, the sacred aspect of it is the rock, the mountain, hand to the mountain, hand to rock. And that is the most sacred oath. He even tells us, you know, this is our most sacred oath. For Elrond, the most sacred thing he can swear on is the memory of his father. Not his father himself, but the memory of his father.
Yes.
Why do you think he makes that distinction?
Because that memory is the last thing he really has of his father, and it is ultimately precious to him, would be my answer to that. His father is long lost at this point, long, long gone. Father and mother, of course.
Right.
And
brother.
And brother, yes. Yes, indeed. And brother. Poor old Elrond, he's been through a bit already.
I'm going to say, doomed to sorrow? Yeah, check.
Yes.
What else have you got?
Yeah. I think that I would read this as he holds that memory close. Mm-hmm. Can't hold your father close, he's gone. Mm. But you can hold that memory close. And he was also only a very young child when his father left, if you like.
Yeah.
So the memories will be very, very precious indeed.
Yeah.
And just to sort of project forward, go forward thousands of years, and Elrond, the Council of Elrond, is the one who tells so much of the lore. Because Elrond is a repository of memory. He's mm-hmm. been around for so long. And somehow he seems to have an unlimited memory bank. You know, he can keep all of this in there.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Right. I can barely remember what happened yesterday. But Elrond, he holds memories for literal thousands of years.
Yeah.
So and I think memory is important to him.
Yes, this memory is part of that whole thing. And whether or not it's joyful or sorrowful, it is precious to him. One might even say it is sacred. Yes. Whereas he knows his father, astonishing as he was human elf, elf human, whatever word you want. You know, I don't like the half and half term that starts with a P. That's out of my memory right now. Listeners, write in. The notion that he would swear on his father rather than the memory of his father also seems to tell me that, you know, I know my dad's not a god. You know, it's usually the Valar or, you know, Eru or someone like that on whom one would swear. Although let us point out that this is not advisable. And again, Elrond knows this better than most because of the Oath of Feanor. And he later evokes that in Lord of the Rings. This is something the Prancing Pony podcast pointed out, and it just had my jaw on the floor. Elrond is the one who's telling Gimli, no, swearing an oath may not strengthen a quaking heart. It may break it.
Mm.
And he lived with the exact consequences of that.
Indeed.
So oaths and Elrond, you know, they're
he knows they're more dodgy.
They're more than just a casual promise, and he knows this, and we'll see subsequent episodes how very important it is to him. And so to swear on that which is the most precious thing to him is an equivalent oath to Durin's swearing on the rock. And I love the way we see this contrast of cultures.
Yes.
In this one simple ritual of swearing an oath. As opposed to, yeah, I promise.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
Now, yeah. So, just that one simple thing, so much.
So, I think we've, pardon the pun, mined that.
As much as we can, yes.
Yes, you knew where I was going.
I saw it coming.
It's all right, folks. I'll be here all week.
So would you like to read our next synopsis?
Yes, I'll continue this next bit. Okay. So, meanwhile, back on Numenor. Jailed together, Halbrand advises Galadriel to identify the thing that her opponent most fears and then give them a means of mastering it so that she can master them. She realizes that it's the king in the tower who she needs to see, but Miriel is afraid to let her do so. An escort arrives to take Galadriel back to the docks to send her to Middle-earth. She overcomes all of the soldiers. Well, of course she does.
Hello.
Tosses them into her former cell, which is funny, and escapes. Halbrand prevents Farazon from pulling his sword on her and tells him where Galadriel is going, because of course he does.
Gee, thanks, Halbrand. You know, this was the time when I first said to myself, oh dear.
Mm-hmm.
Oh dear. This just sounds too much like Sauron, and I really hope it's because he worked for Sauron, was his personal assistant, but you know, I was not fond of the Halbrand is Sauron notion at that time, but I've gotten over it. You know, I've had therapy. I'm fine now.
Oh, okay. So long as you're good. Okay, that's
I'm good.
All right.
I'm good, yes.
Talked your way through the problem. Always exactly. good to do that.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, Halbrand shows himself here to be a manipulator.
To the
so that immediately, I mean, that's red flags all over the place, right?
Yeah. because she jumps to the first conclusion of, you know, find out what your enemy fears and then, you know, shove it in their face or whatever. He said, no. Show them how to overcome it. And then you've mastered them. Just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slightly terrifying.
Slightly.
So Galadriel makes her way to the top of the tower, only to be confronted by Miriel, who tells her that there is a garrison waiting to escort her to her ship. And Galadriel realizes that Halbrand has betrayed her. She's chastened by the king's condition and asks Miriel why she's not following in his footsteps. Miriel shows her a palantir, which shows the great wave destroying all, and tells her that the portent of an elf coming to Numenor is the beginning of that event. Galadriel says that it could well be that by not supporting her, Miriel will cause the downfall, but Miriel refuses to change her mind.
So here we see the source of the great wave image that we saw in the very opening of the episode.
Yeah.
And it's made clear that this is something that Miriel has been living with ever since her father was forced into exile.
Yes.
Because it was that night that he showed it to her.
Right. Yeah. So now we've had these visions of the wave. They've shared these visions. And it's where they go from here, isn't it? Because they both have different perspectives on the problem. Miriel thinks that the best way to protect Numenor is to get the elf off the island, whereas Galadriel thinks that the best way to protect the entire world is to put Halbrand back on his throne. Oops.
Now, do you think that there is anything ritualistic about looking into the palantir?
Oh, yes. I think so. I mean, the whole idea of looking into the palantir, it's not like, you know, picking up your cell phone and dialing somebody. It doesn't work like that. I think you have to really kind of give yourself over to the vision that the palantir gives you. And it's quite a gift to be given these visions. It, you know, it doesn't mean you've got to pass some kind of test before you can. I mean, we'll see later on that other people can access the palantir. But still, I think that there is maybe personal ritual rather than communal ritual about it.
It's
about, you know, giving your mind over in some ways to accept the vision.
Interesting. See, this is, I kind of bumped on this for a while because my understanding of the palantir was just, it was used as a communication device. And I think there's only one time in one sentence it says that people could see visions as well as communicate. And so I said, oh, okay, fine. Because I did actually think of them more like cell phones, you know, really hyped up cell phones and whatnot. And they kept the kingdoms together and so on. This is mostly from Lord of the Rings for those who might not have read that yet. But they've definitely chosen to really emphasize the vision aspect. And at this point, as far as we know, play down the communication aspect. Although Miriel does know that there are other palantiri, and she says, but where they are, none can say. Well, is it they don't say because they don't want to say? And are they still communicating in some fashion with them? So,
interesting.
I'll be interested to see where this goes from here. So I can carry on if you like.
Absolutely. Yes.
At night, Theo tries to escape. He is rescued by the unexpected appearance of Elrondir, and they both leave for the forest, chased by orc arrows. Bronwyn joins them, and they manage to escape into the rising sun. The music transitions beautifully to Disa singing to the rocks, pleading for the lives of the trapped miners. Afterwards, she thanks Elrond for having been there, saying that it may have saved Durin's life. She apologizes for having lied to him, and Elrond says that she did so out of love for her husband, and so there was nothing else to remember.
This is one of my favorite moments of the entire season.
Absolutely incredible.
Breathtaking. I mean, you've got that chase through the forest, which is scary. You know, they do that really well. It's terrifying.
Yes, they do.
And then the three of them burst out of the forest into the sunlight, the music is rising behind them, and then it transitions into Disa's singing. It's Bear McCreary, what are you? This is yes. Glorious, absolutely glorious piece of music. And the transition from the music into the singing is just insane. It's so good.
It's just, you don't know what's happening. You're utterly, utterly bewildered, but it is so beautiful.
It really is. And then chilling. When we go down into the mine and we see what Disa is doing, oh boy, this is just astonishing. There are moments from this season that stick in my mind, and mm-hmm. this is absolutely one of them.
Yes.
It's beautiful and it's compelling. And you feel her communication with the stone, with the rock around her.
Yes, yes.
Oh my goodness, it is just glorious.
Yes, yes. Disa sings to the rocks, imploring them to return the bodies of the trapped miners with the breath still in them. And that imploring is palpable.
Yeah, because she's not mastering the rocks.
No,
she's not telling them what to do.
No, she's pleading. She's pleading.
Yeah.
Asking for this gift. And it's not a solo song either. You have a double line facing inwards of both men and women dwarves, and they all of them, their hair is unbound and they're holding lights and they're singing pedal tones, you know, the low register fundament of a chord, as a sort of almost a drone aspect, while Disa is doing this amazing vocalization, which reminded me of the Black and African tradition called the moans,
oh.
which is this wordless singing, and it can appear over a blues or a gospel song. It can appear in a lot of different instances from the African American tradition, of which I know almost nothing. So I really hope there are listeners who can write in and tell us some more about this and tell us. And particularly me, if you think that this is a fair connection or not.
I would love that, yes.
This is what came to my mind. And there are other dwarves watching, present, almost in a sense holding the whole thing, but not necessarily actually singing it. And then there are drums, because of course dwarves almost always seem to need drums, but used in this incredibly beautiful way. And there's a fireplace and they're all holding lanterns, so there is light, but Disa herself is standing in a shaft of light.
Yeah.
So one of those famous lighting systems that they have, you know, in Khazad-dûm and its glory. And she'll lift up her hands. And as this goes on, we hear the mountain rumble and we see it's almost like on the side, this sort of flat part of the rock, and then there's a standing up part behind and the wall and so forth. We actually see the seams shift and it looks like they're leaking some kind of moisture. It's almost as if the mountain is weeping in response to the pleading and the fear and the grief that may come. And I didn't notice that the first time I watched it. So if listeners don't know what I'm talking about, go back and watch that scene again. It's really quite
and
astonishing.
And why would you not want to watch that scene again? Because,
well, hello.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the ceremony, and Elrond is there too, and that really fascinated me, that they would allow an elf to be present to this ritual, which has got to be so vulnerable.
Right.
And a powerful expression of their culture, and they're allowing this person from another race, as they consider it, to be present. That speaks to me of their recognition of his relationship to Elrond. And I can just see Disa saying, don't you dare tell him to leave. He's standing
who's
right
in charge? Who's in
there.
Charge right here?
Right. I am your crown princess, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, this is a sacred moment. She's communing with the rock. And you're right, to have somebody from outside even allowed to see this is extraordinary.
I think so. And of course, Elrond had been so fascinated when Disa was explaining to him at their dinner how she sounds to the rocks when they're mining. And he expresses this interest and say that's it sounds wonderful. And I don't even remember if he says, I'd love to see it someday, but that undercurrent, I think, is there in that scene. And so now here he is witnessing it at last. And it ends with Prince Doran coming to say that all of the miners have been removed from the shaft alive. So it really is just an amazing, amazing scene. Okay. And I like one of the things that shows me dwarves are very musical people.
Yes. Yes. You're right.
In this rendition, which one might not have thought before.
Yeah, good point. Okay, do you want to finish off that synopsis?
Sure. Durin is furious that his father has decided to seal off the entire mine. Elrond responds to Durin's rage by saying that he wishes that he could hear just one more word from his father, even if it were only in criticism. He tells Durin not to waste what time he has left. Durin goes to apologize to the king, and the king tells him that there is nothing to forgive, that he is always with him, even in anger, perhaps especially in anger. His father also tells him that their people believe that when a new dwarf king is crowned, the voices of all his forebears flow into him, sharing with him their counsel and their wisdom, even their mistakes. He tells his son that, quote, ever I am with you, even in anger, perhaps especially in anger.
Well, that moment of him saying, when a new king of the dwarves is crowned, all the wisdom of all previous kings enter into the newly crowned king. Mm-hmm. You can imagine that as being part of the ritual of crowning the new king.
Yes.
Is that this is a moment when all the dwarves who are there witnessing the coronation will believe that into the body of the new king is flowing at that moment all of the experience and spirit and everything else of the previous kings that came before. It's not like they've told us about, oh, and this is what happens at a coronation. But, you know, we can envision this as being a part of the belief system that lies behind the coronation.
And we've recently witnessed a coronation over your neck of the woods.
Yes.
And I almost think that this description of the wisdom flowing in is not dissimilar to the moment of consecration.
Yes.
That you're receiving the blessing, if you will, of that which they find most sacred. I hope I'm not offending anybody by saying this, because I realize that the consecration is a sacred act. I feel that this is sacred to the dwarves in a very similar way.
Yeah, I would say so. It calls back to, if you're talking about the coronation of a British monarch, it calls back to the whole concept of the divine right of kings, that the monarch was, you know, chosen by God, and therefore God is actually putting them in this place, and that God is always on their side. Possibly asking the wrong person here, because I'm a committed Republican. I dislike the entire existence of the royal family here in the UK. But that's no secret to anyone who knows me. But you're right. There is a sense of the sacred happening within a coronation, because there is always the involvement of somebody extremely high up in the church, the Archbishop of Canterbury, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Because it has to be somebody like that who puts the crown on the head, because it's the connection between the Christian God, obviously, and the monarch being crowned. It's symbolizing God actually being the one who is ordaining that this person is the monarch.
Right. That priestly function, which I realize in contemporary times is probably not, you know, focused on very much by most folks. But what I see here is, for the dwarves, it is their ancestors that make sacred the new monarch by flowing down into him in or her. Well, I guess it's always him with the dwarves. Although Disa might have something to say about that. We'll see.
Yes. Queen Disa. would definitely have something to say about it.
Disa, right? At any rate, that's what I was thinking of when I heard him talk about this. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the exact language shift, but the language shifts from king to father.
Yes.
Which I find very touching and moving. In fact, there's a lot of father-son stuff in this episode.
Yes. Throughout. Starting with Adar and the orcs.
Yeah. And you have Elendil and Isildur and, Terry have the two Dorins. So. Shall we wrap it up with the final synopsis?
Final synopsis, then.
Durin tells his father that, through Elrond, Gil-galad has invited him to dinner at Lindon. The king asks what his intuition tells him. Durin responds that Elrond has said there was no ill intent from Gil-galad, but his intuition says that there is something more at work. The king affirms this, praises his son, and tells him to go to Lindon and find out what. Then back at Os Tirith, Bronwyn thanks Elrondir for saving Theo, who replies that he has a message from Adar. They must swear fealty to him or they will be destroyed by the orcs. Meanwhile, off in the corner, Waldreg tells Theo that he knows that Theo has his sword hilt. He hints a little bit at what it is and encourages Theo to save his strength for the coming of the beautiful servant.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally back in Numenor, as Galadriel walks toward the tender that will take her to the ship from Middle-earth, petals from the white tree begin to fall. Elendil and Muriel know what this means, and we hear the theme of the faithful starting up with the guitar again, which I associate with Elendil. So Muriel summons her people to court and declares her intention to escort Galadriel back to the Southlands herself to aid them in their fight against the orcs. In the court and across the city, volunteers are sought for cavalry to support their queen. Isildur, Ontanmo, and Valendil all step forward.
Mm.
Very dramatic ending, very moving ending. I mean, as a Quaker, I don't think much of war. But what I see in this is the willingness of a people to risk their lives in support of their monarch and their nation, if you will, their country, their other people. And, seeing all those people sticking their hands up and saying, sure, I'll risk death in battle. There is something honorable in that, however you might feel about violence or killing people. Or
It's going to be interesting to see how we go from that kind of feeling to the kind of Numenor that is going to get drowned by the wave.
I know. There's going to be a lot of compression or else a lot left out.
Yes.
Yeah, we knew that there would kind of have to be, wouldn't there? Now, what I'm wondering is, do you think that there is some ritual involved in seeking the volunteers? Or is this the first time that they have requested armies to go fight somewhere? Because who would they be fighting?
Well, let's remember by this point in the history of Numenor, this is not a great point in the history of Numenor if we look at Tolkien's own writings, because they've already started their imperialist notions. Not only have they established outposts on the shores of Middle-earth, all the way up and down, but they've also started taking what they want and enslaving people. Now, we're not seeing this in Numenor yet.
Exactly.
So we don't know if this is something that they're actually going to bring in the show, or if this is something that will suddenly be introduced and it will be part of, and this is why Numenor is going to sink. Don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if we go by what Tolkien has written, then no, this is definitely not the first time they've had to put together a bunch of soldiers, because you don't subjugate the locals by saying, hi, have a hot dog. You know, you've actually got to go in there and start waving a sword around to terrify them, which, of course, is what we know did happen. They terrified
Absolutely.
The people along the coast.
Yes.
So, I don't think this is the first time at all.
Yeah, they became colonizers in both in terms of land and in terms of goods And as you say, eventually, once Sauron was in running things in terms of slaves and victims and so forth.
Yes. Yeah.
But if that's the case, why are they still at a stage of needing to seek volunteers? Why isn't there already a standing army in the way that there's a standing sea guard?
Excellent question.
And who are the sea guards defending us against? I mean, maybe pirates, but
it's golly, a long way for the pirates to sail, by the way.
It surely is. It surely is. And how, you know, supposedly Numenor is so much more developed in terms of technology and all the rest of it than anyone else. Do they need a really extensive sea guard? It sure seems like they've been around for a while. They have rituals, unquestionably. It's very clear. But here they are, you know, asking people to stick their hands in the air. And I don't know. I get a sense that, you know, this is a new thing.
Mm.
How much do the Numenoreans train on their own? I mean, we will see some training in subsequent episodes, but, you know, they do manage to find some armor somewhere. So, I mean, it's mildly confusing to me. I mean, it's a very dramatic moment.
Of course.
And I still appreciate, you know, the willingness of citizens to defend their queen. But it just, I don't know, it's a little odd. Mm. And I mean, maybe they made up a new ritual on the spot. You can certainly do that. But the whole thing about calling for volunteers and, you know, people raising their hands and that kind of thing. It seemed more spontaneous than ritualistic to me somehow.
I agree. So what can we conclude from the rituals we've come across in today's episode?
Well, there's the astonishment of orcs and their rituals.
Yes.
Definitely deeper sense of dwarves.
Yes.
It seemed like most of, well, a large chunk of what we talked about today were a couple of dwarvish rituals and what they represented. And again, highlighting the differences between their culture in this series and what we've seen in other series. And I really like that.
Yeah.
I really like that a lot. There's still, you know, there's still the fiery people who scream at each other when they're upset kind of thing. But there's tenderness and artistry of more than just carving stone. You know, that singing was melting.
Yes. It's
like the rock itself was melting. And that was what the seam that looked like water was all about.
Yeah. I think what we've got from the rituals from this episode is it has drawn us further into our understanding, as ritual does, as witnessing rituals will do, of the cultures within Middle Earth. We're getting greater picture of who they are. It's a really good way of telling us a lot about these individual cultures, is to show us some of the rituals that they have. And they can be a real shortcut to meaning because of that.
Yes. Yes.
Watching the dwarves and what they're doing, watching that moment with Adar killing the orc, tells us so much about these cultures without them having to say, and by the way, this is something that we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I think small s sacred.
Yes.
Rather than capital S sacred.
Yep.
You know, tell me what is sacred to you and I'll know a lot about you as a person, but if you tell me that this is a communal event, then I'll know a lot about your culture. Which is why I think we'll be seeing fewer rituals as we go along through the episodes.
Because they don't need to anymore.
They don't need to. They've established their foundation and they're moving along to tell their story.
Okay. So I think we've covered everything, I think.
Well, everything that we found. Perhaps other people will write in and tell us, well, what about this? Which would be great.
It would
love
be great.
Hear more.
But I think we do have some feedback.
And speaking of feedback, yes, we do indeed have some feedback, and we will get to it right after a quick break. Welcome back. Before we share our feedback today, we have a clarification to offer. In commenting on the appearance of the veiled elvish women in Lindon, we alluded to the connection with the showrunner's religious beliefs. Several online sources have indicated that J.D. Payne is a member of the Mormon Church. While some Mormon women are named as sisters, the term generally refers to those women who are recognized as missionaries. There's little indication of any of the usual behaviors of nuns in this role. And at this point, we don't know McKay's religious affiliation, if any. So just wanted to put that bit of expanded knowledge in there.
Thanks for that, Marilyn.
Sure thing. So let's get to the messages that we received from several listeners. Now, just remember, because of our timing for recording and releasing episodes, this week's feedback pertains to episode 1, A Shadow from the Past. Sara, will you get us started?
Sure. Oh, one of my favorite people, Bonnie Matham from the PPP. She says, loved it. My favorite bit was what you and Sara, or me and you, said about the female servants dressed in white on the ship taking the elves back to Valinor. They creeped me out. Yeah, you and me both, Bonnie.
Yeah, not the only one. Fru Elisa from the Lorehounds says, loving the first episode ritual talk. I also couldn't believe the producers made those nuns serving elves. Totally not Tolkien and rather ridiculous.
And BLHH, Brit from PPP, said, absolutely loved it. Talking about Galadriel and her unfinished business was fantastic when you consider it in the full context of her story. How it ends with her leaving for Valinor, paralleling a traditional ghost story where she can't move on to the next plane of existence until her business is concluded. That's a really great point, by the way.
Isn't that wonderful? I really like that a lot, Britt. Thanks for bringing that up.
And the feedback finishes, loved the episode, looking forward to the next. Yay!
Then we have Eris, who said simply, but nicely, I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Eris.
Thank you. I'm
yes,
glad
indeed.
You did.
Thanks for actually getting in touch to let us know. We do appreciate that.
Indeed.
And then somebody with one of my favorite usernames,
yes.
2KDS, 2DGSs, from the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcasting Network said, hi, Marilyn and Sara. Hi, two kids, two dogs.
Hello.
I rewatched episode 1 of the series in preparation to listen to your podcast. So glad I did, because as you were talking, I was able to so clearly remember the scenes. I agree with you that the veils were over the top, reminded me of the Silent Sisters in Game of Thrones. Yes, I remember seeing that. But I definitely didn't see them as servants. All the elves have different jobs or skills. Some are warriors, some are speechwriters, some are smiths. I saw these women as those drawn to the service of preparing people and then accompanying them back to Valinor. For them, it would be a sacred calling. Sacred with a small s, as
right.
you've been
right.
using, Marilyn. But then you mention that they're also in a later episode standing behind a table. If they clear the dishes, then I will definitely stand corrected. Good point.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. Also, in the scene of the boat going to Valinor, I thought they were actually hearing the music of Valinor, that it wasn't just background score. It made the scene with the clouds opening that much more impactful for me. They were experiencing the return through sight and sound. Yeah, I love that. And I agree that part of the ritual returning was to discard the armor and weapons of Middle-earth.
Yes, definitely. And I think, too, that they were hearing the music. In other words, it was diegetic. And so if we said anything to imply otherwise, then apologies, because it wasn't speaking clearly. So that's it for this episode. Write in and let us know what you think, any suggestions you might have for rituals for us to talk about, and anything else you'd like to share with us. We welcome your feedback at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com. or on the Lorehounds Discord server, where we have a special channel set up just for Rings and Rituals.
Now, on the Lorehounds website, there's also a contact form and a voicemail feature. Look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We're aiming to publish 2 episodes a month, but if you follow any of the Lorehounds podcasts, you'll hear our ads, and they'll let you know when the next episode is approaching.
Also, be sure to check out the other podcasts supported by the Barovian Broadcasting Network. That's Properly Howard Movie Review with Stephen Anthony, We'll Shift Dust with Alicia, and of course, John and David on the Main Lorehounds podcast. Links for all of these are also in the show notes.
Now, our thanks to our recording engineer and editor, Bob, to David and John, our producers, and to John for arranging our theme music, as well as all the others who support us along the way.
If you would like to support us and the podcast, rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice, although I understand that Apple is particularly fine. Or find us on Patreon at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Subscribers will get access to ad-free versions of all the podcasts, as well as many other benefits.
Until next time, then, remember, beauty has great power to heal the soul. Halvar, farewell for now.
Nakamin, until we meet again.